Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I'm joined today by Catherine Mangu Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and by Thaddeus Russell, a historian who is the author of A Renegade History of the United States and the founder of Renegade University, an online multimedia set of courses and lectures. You can get more information about that at thaddeusrussell.com. Catherine, Thad, thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let's talk about the Syria bombing that President Donald Trump ordered last week. He said that he did it out of essentially humanitarian concerns, saying that in the wake of an apparent gas attack by the Assad forces on innocents, particularly children, that killed about 60 people, he had no choice. And I'm quoting from his statement on it. It is in the vital national security interest of the United States to prevent and deter the use of deadly chemical weapons. Thad, you're writing a book that's a companion to A Renegade History of the United States about U.S. foreign policy. Does Trump's rationale for bombing Syria, a Syrian airbase, does it make sense to you? Does it resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, it's the return to normal American foreign policy, I suppose. I mean, this is the foreign policy idea that Trump was railing against all through the campaign. And a lot of people have seen the bombing of Syria as evidence that he was lying all that time, not serious about it. But I think what's happening more is that it's a battle of different factions within the White House, and the traditional foreign policy types represented by the generals, in particular Mattis, I think are just winning now. And I think that's what happened with Syria. That's why Trump made that move. I don't know exactly why, although we know that Trump, you know, was vacillating sometimes between non-interventionism and more traditional ways of thinking about America's grand exceptional role in the world. But I think clearly the Bannon faction, the Stephen Miller faction, is waning or being pushed out. And now it's a return to the good old days of Wilsonianism, of the United States doing such things as killing people to save them. So there's a lot of cheering about how we're finally getting back to normal, which of course means more death.
Which is amazing too, because you know, nothing unites a country, and this is not simply the United States, but being at war or doing an act of war, it's you know, people like Nancy Pelosi approved of it. Chuck Schumer, Trump's enemies who have had nothing good to say about him, are suddenly rallying to his side. Why is the U.S. humanitarian intervention kind of idea is that it comes out of Wilson? It really didn't exist before that, and then has it changed since kind of coming to the forefront after Woodrow Wilson?
Well, if you want to do a quick history thing, it actually does originate before Wilson. It originates with the Civil War. I mean, so I often say that Reconstruction was, or the South was, America's first Afghanistan. I mean, that was really the rationale.
We're never going to actually get out of Afghanistan, because I'm pretty sure that the U.S. still occupies most of the South, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't love that thesis of endless war, although it certainly has looked that way over the last 150 years. But yeah, I mean, Wilson really made it a coherent ideology, and it became dominant after his presidency. It's been a remarkable bipartisan consensus that the United States should take care of the rest of the world. And by take care, you know, they mean essentially invading, colonizing, and changing and uplifting people into our own image by whatever means necessary. And the only sort of difference of opinion on that between the two parties over the last 100 years is how best to do that, whether it's just, you know, stark colonialism coming in and seizing and putting people in our schools, et cetera, or whether it's through, you know, manipulation through trade and the imbalance in power between the United States and the rest of the world. But yeah, so I mean, that was the one thing about Trump that was, I don't want to say exciting, but it was certainly interesting and novel, was that he was calling that into question through the campaign, at least most of the time, not all the time. But Bannon and Miller certainly were, and that's what I talked about last time I was on this podcast, I think, after the election. And, you know, that's what anti-war people like me were sort of hoping would take hold, would be this at least questioning of Wilsonianism, of American exceptionalism.
Well, If I can also bring up that previous conversation, which is online, if you go to iTunes or if you go to SoundCloud, you can find it shortly after the election. But you had said in that Hillary Clinton was clearly an internationalist in terms of classic internationalist interventionist, that the U.S. has to support world order or create world order. But I remember you also saying that you thought Trump would be worse in the Middle East, but he wouldn't be going all over the world searching for countries to improve. So in a way, does this, it does seem as if we're moving more deeply into Syria. I mean, his administration has been very careful to say this was a one-off and it was just to show Assad we mean business. But do you think this is actually a move towards kind of internationalism that, as you were saying, he campaigned against pretty explicitly?
Yeah, I don't know. Who knows? I mean, again, I think it depends on what goes on in the White House. And I really do think there's a major fight going on inside the White House. Many people have reported on this. No one knows for sure, but we know that Bannon was removed from the NSC the day before the strike against Syria. We know that Mattis has always had a different view of how to deal with Iran and its allies like Syria than Bannon has. Bannon and Miller are pretty classic isolationists. They want a clash of civilizations, but what that means to them is removing Muslims from the West, not going into Muslim areas and attempting to conquer and colonize them. Mattis, we don't know exactly, but we know that he's had a pretty deep hostility toward Iran and the mullahs who run the place for a long, long time for various reasons. He's never come out straight up and said, I'm for regime change, but he has certainly taken a very, very militant and aggressive posture against Iran for a long time. And he's a man of the military. You know, he's been in the military his entire life, and this is kind of what we do. You know, we fight the bad guys, we go there and destroy the bad guys regardless. I mean, and so I think this is very clearly represents traditional American military foreign policy thinking.
I am sorry to hear that. Catherine, I know you're a big Game of Thrones fan and whatnot. Could we have created a more fucked up situation than Syria where I guess we're there mostly to fight ISIS, and on that front we're allies of a sort with Iran and Syria and Russia, but we're of course enemies of all of them at the same time. It just seems, do you have any sense of what we might accomplish through this type of action?
You know, people are, I think, mourning the loss of what was always a tenuous hope that Trump might break this pattern. I think the sort of the details of who's in and who's out and Mattis and Bannon, while that stuff is all incredibly interesting and of incredible import, I also think there's just the macro point that presidents become more warlike after becoming president. And I was actually trying to think if there are any exceptions to that. And I was like, oh, isn't it handy that we have a historian here on the phone? So I'd be interested, Dad, to hear what you have to say. But more generally, I think because Trump was so good at saying A and not A for so much of the campaign, you know, I'm looking back now at his big foreign policy statement from 2016, from about this time in 2016, where he says, I thought the approach of fighting Assad and ISIS simultaneously was madness and idiocy. They're fighting each other, and yet we're fighting both of them. You know, we're fighting both of them. And it's like, yeah, that guy sounds pretty sane. That sounds right. It's,
yeah,
it's
and at,
madness
at one
and
point,
idiocy.
He talked about how, why not let Russia do some of the heavy lifting, and then, well, we can come in afterwards or something like that.
I think the bigger thing that's going on here is, I mean, it's the thing that Madeleine Albright was pilloried for saying so long ago. What's the point of having this superb military if we're always talking about it, but we can't use it? Once you have the military, you want to use it. And I think that's a pretty consistent pattern, though. I would love to hear at least one shining counterexample if Thad can dredge one up for me.
Can I suggest one? And Thad, I suspect that I'm wrong about this, or certainly that you have more knowledge, but Ronald Reagan is actually kind of an interesting character where he talked an enormously huge game, and yet he probably was one of the least, he was one of the slowest guys to deploy the military anywhere. And of course, famously in Lebanon, he got the hell out after a certain point. So I wonder, is Ronald Reagan a counterexample here of somebody who pursued a massive military increase in the military budget, talked a lot about stuff, but actually, you know, compared to Bill Clinton, made more specific troop deployments than Reagan did?
Yeah, so Reagan is actually, I'd say the Trump administration so far on foreign policy has been very much a replay of the Reagan administration, and there's a direct connection as well that's very important that a lot of people don't know about. So within the Reagan administration, there was a faction fight, very similar to the one that's going on now between the Schultz, the George Schultz faction, who were pretty much what we would call, they were sort of the original neocons, at least the ones mm-hmm. in the White House. They called for regime change and preemptive war, and sort of a global police role by the United States. And the opposing faction was represented by Caspar Weinberger and his assistant, K.T. McFarland, who is now deputy NSA. So,
well, she was just canned from that, though, because she is going to become ambassador to Singapore, which would suggest
there
along
you go.
The lines of, you were saying Bannon was removed from the NSC.
There you go.
That maybe that's a pretty big signal. Yeah.
There you go. So McFarland actually, she wrote what is known as the Weinberger Doctrine, which was an internal memo in which Weinberger laid out a new way of approaching foreign policy, which was a rejection of preemptive interventions and regime change and this global universal moral role by the United States in foreign policy. It was for the use of overwhelming force when there was an enemy who represented some sort of existential threat to the United States. So it was not a peacenik policy, but it was not interventionist in the old way. And McFarland actually wrote that. And that came out of the common analysis among the historians who've studied that, in particular Andrew Bacevich, is that that represented the military's point of view, right? Because the military was very, very tired of going to these countries they had never heard of previously and having tens of thousands or 50 or hundreds of thousands of their men dying for a cause that was unclear, like in Vietnam, et cetera. And what they wanted was to only fight truly bad guys who represented a threat to the United States. And when they did that, to deploy overwhelming force to make sure that they won. So it was very much a response to the Vietnam War. Now, that fight between the Weinberger realist faction and the Schultz neoconservative faction continues, and it's continued in every administration ever since, even in the Bush administration, the junior Bush administration. The neocons had the upper hand, of course, at the beginning, and then began to actually to lose out to a realist faction toward the end. But it's very clear that it's been happening in the Trump administration. However, with the demotion of Bannon and McFarland, you know, it's looking more and more very quickly like, unfortunately, the old school is winning out.
It's peculiar, too, because it's not as if we don't have like really recent examples of attempts to affect regime change, you know, go horribly wrong. I mean, when you were talking about Vietnam and whatnot, I recall dimly in my youth that George H.W. Bush, one of the great outcomes, according to him, of the first Gulf War, when we invaded with a large force of allies, including all of the countries surrounding Iraq after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, but that we had kicked, we'd kicked the Vietnam syndrome. And that was at least, you know, kind of a clear win in terms of it was an relatively easy military operation for the United States. I think the only U.S. soldiers who were killed killed by friendly fire, that type of thing. But, I mean, what more do we need as direct reminders of the failure of a kind of intervention of foreign policy, in a century that has been marked by at least three major campaigns that have ended disastrously in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, and we're pretending that we're not in six or seven countries right now droning people. I don't know, Catherine. Do you have any sense of what do you do to get Americans to pay attention to the idea that doing the same thing over and over again in foreign policy tends to yield the same result and it sucks?
I don't think the problem is exactly Americans. I mean, Americans are, by and large, in polls supportive of wars once we get into them. But I actually think this is something where it's much more about the locus of power. It's much more about the sort of small cadre of decision makers, which is why we watch these, McFarland's out and Bannon's out, and what does it all mean? And I think, you know, I think that's why I keep coming back to this idea of you give somebody the tool to intervene in the world incredibly aggressively, however they see fit. And it's just incredibly hard to then say, don't use that tool. And I think, you know, it's, to my mind, the weirdest part of the rhetoric that surrounds a new military action, whether it's bombing or something, less, what's the word we say? Kinetic. Less
right,
kinetic.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always this moment where someone will cite the horrors of war to justify war. And that's eternal. You know, the reason we have to invade the neighboring village is because they, you know, invaded ours. You know, this round in particular, where we're sort of saying, oh, well, this slightly different tool of war was used in a way that we previously decided was outside of the rules. So we're going to inflict, if not identical, fundamentally similar damage in the name of enforcing that norm. Like, that sounds okay, I guess, to people when they think it in their heads and then say it out loud, but it sort of sounds utterly insane on another level. It's always going to come up. It's never going to go away. If Vietnam did not teach us that this particular type of sort of internationalism and interventionism isn't a good idea, I can't imagine what would at this point.
I guess that, let me ask you this, how much of foreign policy do you think in general in an American context, and especially short of kind of global conflict like World War II, where after a certain point, the United States was invaded, Hawaii was bombed, Germany declared war on the United States, et cetera. How much of foreign policy decision-making is really driven by domestic concerns? You know, it seems we're comfortable saying that somebody like Vladimir Putin is kind of rattling chains and being expansionist because his domestic economy is so fucked up. You know, he's got to do something. And, you know, when I think back again to the 90s, Bill Clinton had at least two spectacular military operations, one where he simultaneously bombed sites in, I guess it was Sudan, and was in Afghanistan, I think, and then also when he started bombing in the Yugoslavian War. Those were on the days that Monica Lewinsky was giving grand jury testimony. And then actually the day that his impeachment trial was starting to was beginning. I mean, it was inescapable at that moment to realize that these foreign policy actions were directly tied to domestic concerns. Is that, you know, is there something to say about this with Donald Trump right now, that a foreign policy action is actually more driven by domestic concerns?
Who knows? I don't. My argument in the book I'm writing now about the history of U.S. foreign policy is that these wars have pretty much always been driven actually by ideological concerns, that there has been in the American political class, which has always been very, very different than most Americans. There's always been this tendency in the American political class to think of themselves as the parents and saviors of the world. And it's, you know, it's how do we explain that? I mean, there's a sort of long, you know, of course, Christian tradition, evangelical tradition in the United States, and it's been picked up by people across the political spectrum in the political classes. And this is sort of an intrinsic problem with America as a superpower, which is that there are oceans on either side of it. Americans traditionally have been less intellectual than Europeans, less curious about the world. And so Americans, by and large, are ignoramuses about the world outside the borders. How many Americans could identify Syria on a map, right? I think that's a small single-digit number in percentage. But at the very same time, we've had this evangelical culture, which has been especially pronounced in the political classes who run the place. And then when it became powerful enough to actually have a dominant military, you've had this terrible split between people who actually run the government, who want to go out and do all these things in the rest of the world, and the rest of the country that doesn't even know the rest of the world exists in specific ways. So it's the imperial presidency. That's the issue. I mean, we are not going to teach all Americans world geography and history and the political dynamics of every country in the world. But what we can certainly do, and we could do this quickly, and I was hoping it would happen under Trump because of the left's insane hatred of him. I thought that could actually be useful in this way, in that we could start talking about reducing the power of the presidency, which has been given to the presidency by Congress over the last 100 years, in particular, by the way, under liberal presidents, I might add. But so that's what we should all be focused on, you know, is reducing the ridiculous, horrible power that they have. Trump ordered that strike basically at the drop of a hat. He just pushed a button essentially and sent, you know, dozens of Tomahawk missiles into another country that most Americans have no idea about.
Well, another way that we are focused on a kind of national mission, and of course, I assume that, a big part of Make America Great Again, Trump's rallying campaign slogan, even as he was questioning, the ways in which foreign policy had been conducted this century, a lot of it depends on, if you can beat up a couple of small countries, you feel good about yourself, I suppose. And yesterday in the New York Times, I came across, and I think we've all looked at it, one of the most peculiar attempts to maintain taxpayer funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds PBS. And it was done by the former commander of the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, Stanley McChrystal, who actually argued that PBS was in some measure essential to the success of the United States overall, including the military. Public non-commercial broadcasting, he claimed, is also giving kids social emotional skills like persistence and self-control that are fundamental to success in school, not to mention in the military, the institution where I spent most of my career, writes Stanley McChrystal. This is weird, wild stuff, and it's especially bizarre coming from a guy who got fired from his position for making fun of Joe Biden in a Rolling Stone profile. Catherine, I'll give you first crack at this. Can we even begin to critique this sort of bullshit on stilts coming out of, a legendary military man that somehow Sesame Street and non-commercial broadcasting, teaches kids self-control that will allow them to become good soldiers?
This kind of argument feels to me like, remember when they said, okay, we're banning tobacco and like, who knows what's going to happen next? Probably they'll start telling people they can't even supersize their soda. And everyone was like, ha, 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 that will never happen. That's a ridiculous libertarian scaremongering slippery slope argument. And this feels the same way. Like, oh, at some point someone's going to try to stick up for public broadcasting as like they're going to make the national security case for Sesame Street. And everyone would say like, ha, 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 that will never. And apparently, yes, of course it will happen. Of course it will freaking happen. And my favorite line in really a glorious sequence of argumentation here is when he says, we need public media that acts as our largest classroom. We need broadcasting that treats us like citizens, not simply as consumers. Hmm. Like broadcasting that treats us as consumers is incredibly fucking awesome. Like yeah, the more consumery we are, the better the broadcasting. See HBO, see Netflix series. Like I guess I just... That argument sounds good to a certain type of ear, but it's a dumb one, and that's unfortunate.
I guess, Thad, what really gets my ire up is the idea that you can't even get, I grew up in a time of really shitty kids' cartoons, and I know we all have kids, and Thad and I have a son or sons that are about the same age who grew up. And are growing up, as are your children, Catherine, in a glorious age of absolutely consumer-driven, great kids programming. I had to suffer through the Super Friends where Batman and Robin at the end of each episode would tell you not to wet your finger and stick it in an electrical socket. What do you do with this kind of stuff? This seems to me, it's a callback to some of the stuff you talk about in A Renegade History of just this insane attempt to kind of make everything useful and efficient in American culture, and also at the same time to treat people like sheep who would be gulled along. Like if only, Big Bird whispers the right, lessons in Sesame Street, everything will be good and right with the world.
Right. Okay. Well, now I don't have to. I don't feel like I have to correct you guys because I was a little surprised. I was surprised that you were both characterizing McChrystal's op-ed as irrational and crazy and wild when it is very much a product of progressivism and, in particular, Cold War liberalism. This was his argument is precisely what Cold War liberals were making in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and 80s, which was that we need and then the neocons took it up right after that, which is that we need a unified single American culture that puts everyone in the same box, makes everyone identify as Americans before identifying as individuals, which is necessary to create a very powerful military. It's also necessary to project this one particular form of American culture to the world. So the Pentagon and progressives and, you know, I mean, if you look at like the Kennedy and Johnson administration and then if you look at the Bush administration, that's what those guys were talking about. Irving Kristol, that was his whole thing. That's why we have No Child Left Behind, is that the military needs automatons. They can't have individualism, right? The military, by definition, requires people to subsume their individuality to this bigger thing.
Well,
So PBS, so NPR, PBS, National Cultures, you know, that's part and parcel of it. McChrystal's right. It's horrendous. I agree. I certainly agree with you guys there. I mean, I am no fan of PBS or the military, so I want both of them to be, you know, virtually abolished. But that it's very much, it's not irrational whatsoever. It's part of the same progressive logic.
It'll be a wonderful day when Netflix has enough fighter planes to bomb all the PBS stations in the country. I don't know, you know, it's mind-boggling. And as you were talking, Thad, it reminded me of Kennedy, who in a lot of ways, JFK is the ultimate Cold War figure because he was both, you know, now he gets more claimed, I guess, by liberals and conservatives, although some conservatives like Ira Stoll have pulled him back into their camp. But the whole President's Council on Fitness.
Exactly.
Was an attempt to, you know, like fat, lazy kids who were sitting around watching Leave It to Beaver, you know, how the hell were they going to win World War III? And so you got to get out there and throw a ball and, you know, do five pull-ups. There was at some point, I forget who said it in the 2000s.
Can I say, I never did a single pull-up. Every fucking year, there'd be a poster of Arnold Schwarzenegger and like George Bush or whatever staring at me while I dangled from that bar for what felt like an eternity. Like, I'm unconvinced that contributed to our nation's military readiness, me dangling from that pull-up bar.
Well, there was a guy in the 2000s, I forget, a general who testified somewhere before Congress saying that childhood obesity was the greatest threat to the American nation. And it's like, Jesus Christ, you know. I say that as the son of a World War II infantryman who had rheumatic fever, he had scarlet fever, he had no teeth left from childhood diseases. And to his credit, I mean, like everybody in the U.S. military, I mean, they mobilized very quickly for World War II. And it's kind of amazing. I mean, these guys rose to a military challenge that was pretty daunting. And within, you know, a couple of months of basic training, they were able to go over and kick the ass of both the Japanese Imperial Army, which was very good, and the German Army, which was pretty good. So, I think we can probably get by without PBS or the President's Council on Fitness for a while.
Well, yeah, but I think you guys are still a little bit off here because, I mean, a lot of the military recruiting basically happens in the schools through programs just like that, right?
So yeah, Marine, right.
Yeah, I mean, so it's all connected, and I think we should attack these things not as being crazy and irrational, but as part of this broader system that we loathe.
It can be both, though, right? I mean, it can be true that is an effective pipeline for populating our military insofar as it is a blunt instrument, but you can also say you could simultaneously hold the view these programs are utterly ridiculous and these arguments are utterly ridiculous and we need a gigantic military and a unified American culture, right? I mean, I happen to think the latter isn't, but I happen to think that both are true, but you know, just because in fact there is a history of recruiting kids out of public schools for the military doesn't mean dangling from the pull-up bar was anything in the positive direction of actually accomplishing right. that.
But
right?
But this is where I think we agree that, you know, there's a larger kind of cultural work being done by these types of programs. And I was I guess it was last week or a couple of weeks ago, I was writing some stuff about the National Endowments for the Arts and for the Humanities, which are very much in the idea or in the mold. And they were coming out of, again, a Kennedy vision, which was implemented by LBJ, to say, you know what, we have a great culture and we like the arts just as much as the Russians like ballet, and that we have a world culture that is the equal or superior of any other country. And that creates a sense of purpose, a sense of unity, a sense of national superiority in many ways. And I always come back to something that Matt Welch and I wrote about in the Declaration of Independence. For all of that, and that meant during the Cold War, and my favorite Cold War figure in a lot of ways is Van Cliburn, the Texas piano prodigy, who was pushed out in front of Russian audiences because he could tickle the ivories just as good as any kind of classically trained pianist from Russia. And we came back to the point in the book, which was that nobody ever named an anti-communist revolution after Van Cliburn. They named them after the Velvet Underground, whose records exactly were banned and spurned in America as much
That's
as
right.
they were in the United States, and that it's actually America's low culture, or what used to be called low culture, now might be considered commercial culture or popular culture, which is radically transformative precisely because it is uncontrollable and it's insistently individualistic. So, yeah, and I guess, you know, thank you. In talking about this, the McChrystal thing just seems so stupid, but it is, and I think it is, and I think it's laughable and risible and it should be seen as such. But it is also part and parcel of a larger kind of cultural program that has very specific ideological and political goals and aims, which are worth attacking at the same time we make fun of him.
Can I say I also had an amazing Cold War flashback last week? I was on a flight that was delayed because a group of Russian rhythmic gymnasts refused to check their hula hoops. And you know, the hula hoop fight started going down. And the minute that I heard the Slavic accent on the team mom slash coach as she angrily stomped her UGG booted foot at the flight attendant, I was fully like, ugh, the Russians still better at gymnastics than we are. Like I went fully back to Cold War mode. So. It's these things are powerful.
Well, that and certainly the Olympics, which are another interesting example of that. They were recreated in 1896 by a French nobleman as a way of kind of revenging or avenging the French defeat in the Franco-Prussian War on the athletic fields. And obviously, and this is something I have to. It took me years to understand why I loved the Olympics so much, and it was because I was a good American in training, and I wanted to see the U.S. kicked the ass of the Russians in, you know, in everything. And I always felt bad that we couldn't beat them in weightlifting. But, you know, we won in the long run, right? I guess. I don't know. So the New York Times publishes Stanley McChrystal's laughable, brief in favor of non-commercial TV, which, Catherine, I mean, it is so right. Like, it's non-commercial because nobody wants to pay for it and nobody wants to watch it.
Except for, of course, the ones that people totally do want to pay for and watch, which, as the old libertarian saw, has it, but that's completely true, don't need PBS support. Like, Big Bird will never die.
Yeah,
he will just rise.
He's on the same station, you know, he's on the same channel as Vice and Veep.
He'll just rise harder and stronger than ever before, yeah.
But the Times also recently called out an issue of Reason that you put together recently. It's the most current one on newsstands now about why the border wall, that is another centerpiece of Trump's presidency, won't work. And in a House editorial talking about Trump's calls for a border wall along the Mexican border, the editors wrote, "The libertarians at Reason magazine have a fine summation of why the wall won't work. If only Mr. Trump would read it or ponder the questions raised by it." Talk a little bit about, like, the major pieces in this issue, what is the basic case of why the wall won't work?
So there's so many pieces to it. We wound up having to do essentially just a roundup of waving our arms in the direction of all the different arguments. But to my mind, some of the most compelling ones are, first that every technology that we have tried for wall building, drug smugglers have already very successfully and even scalably worked their way around. If our goal is to keep people out, then those same techniques will be used to move humans, just as they are now used to move heroin, except for maybe the catapult. I'm assuming we're not going to catapult people over the wall, but, you know, maybe that's just me having insufficient faith in human ingenuity. So I should probably not even say that much. There's the very interesting question of who owns the land along the border. And I think this is something that even if you're not a, you know, don't tread on me libertarian, you should care about. There are Indian reservations there. We have elaborate agreements about how water moves back and forth across the border. We have national park land, which will be the easiest to build on in some ways. But, you know, if you care about preserving untouched wilderness, could easily be a problem. The use of eminent domain at the border is something that I think Reason will be keeping an eye on a lot, because there's going to be a bunch of forcible removal of property in order to build a fence that's not even going to keep people out. Sorry, not a fence, a beautiful 35-foot tall wall that will be aesthetically pleasing if Donald Trump has his way. So there are a lot of arguments, but those are two that really present themselves to me as some of the biggest deals. That and the folks on the border, the folks who actually work the border, they've said that a tall, opaque wall will actually make border enforcement harder. If you can't see people trying to get across the wall until they're on the top of it heading over, that's not great for enforcement. So this idea, again, of sort of totally centrally controlled symbolic action that devalues local problems and local knowledge, the wall is a symbol. Fighting it should be a symbolic battle, and hopefully it will stay at that level because it's never actually going to get built. I think best case scenario here is that incompetence prevents execution.
One of the pieces in this issue, which also has a phenomenal cover that people should look for it online and buy a copy online at reason.com, subscribe. Or at newsstands everywhere. But there was one piece in that also talked about how within 100 miles or 200 miles of an international border is actually – it's considered part of the border zone, and that when you increase enforcement, it allows for essentially immigration or border control stops within those areas. And how does that – you know, what should people know about that policy?
Right. So this is something that I think a lot of American citizens don't understand, that within 100 miles of the border, you have diminished rights. You have less right to privacy. You have, in particular, just much more minimal protections against search. When you're, for instance, driving a vehicle anywhere near the border. Now, anywhere near the border sounds reasonable. Okay, people might come over the border and do something illegal. We need to keep an eye on those guys. But a 100-mile border zone means that the entire state of Michigan is within this zone. So when you start to think of it that way, that all of the citizens of Michigan have diminished rights because of our paranoia about what is or isn't going to come across the border and get us – you know, that starts to look differently. And I think it is just a true thing about human nature that, you can say, okay, crossing the border, you know, the ability to cross the border will incredibly improve the lives of Mexicans and other immigrants who would otherwise suffer in poverty. People are like, eh, people are poor everywhere. But if you say the weed in your glove compartment is more likely to get you in trouble, then people are energized. And two out of every three Americans essentially live in a border zone. Those are the most populous areas in the country. So it's you. It's about you.
It's amazing because looking at that, I'm taping this from Ohio, where I live part of the time. And, you know, large chunks of Ohio, which I always thought of as, you know, an interior state, are covered by it because anything that is basically along the Great Lakes, you're pulling things in. It's really stunning. Thad, what is the longer historical view about anxiety, you know, about immigrants, but also about criminals and criminality and invasion? What are do you see that as informing this latest kind of bubble of toxic gas? You know, that is so much about hardening the United States or creating a kind of fortress America where people can't get in unless we know exactly who they are and where they're going and when they're going to get the hell out.
I don't know. I'm of two minds about the history of xenophobia in this country. I think, again, if you look at, it tends to be, historically at least, I think it's more comes out of, again, the political classes. I mean, it's not really clear that sort of ordinary Americans have been particularly xenophobic. I just wanted to say really quickly, those arguments, by the way, Catherine, that you listed are just fantastic. And I want to say that many libertarians are not libertarian at all when it comes to immigration and the border. And it's quite troubling, and I'm really glad that Reason's doing this. But ordinary Americans have always been interested in trading with foreign countries. They've always been interested in traveling to foreign countries. I mean, we have the numbers on this going back to the 19th century. There is the sort of idea of the redneck in middle America, ready to murder any foreigner who crosses his path, is completely overblown. There's very little evidence of that, but we do certainly have a long history of labor leaders being xenophobic, for obvious reasons. You'd keep the cheap labor out of the country that competes with its members. We have a long history of more sort of like local and state level politicians who are sort of the populist Trump ilk who are xenophobic, but there just isn't that much evidence that it's been a mass phenomenon among Americans. So I don't know.
Add a little support of that in the current moment, it's still true that something like 50% of self-identified Republicans are in favor of giving current illegals a path to citizenship. The numbers go up even more if you talk about just legal status, and it's about 70% of Americans all around. So I think you're right. I mean, even in the current moment, for all of the discussion of this in political classes, most people are kind of like, you know what, this ain't a problem.
You know, I had a moment the other day, actually. I just moved to Oregon recently, and I was signing up at a medical center here to be a member, and a guy walked in right behind me, and he didn't speak any English, and he handed the person at the counter a note, and I heard her talking. She said, "So, oh, you want Medicare or Medicaid? You want Medicaid?" And he said, "Yes." And you want, for how many people? 9 people. And do you have any source of income? No. Do you have any employment? No. And what language do you speak? Somali. And this is in a town outside of Salem, Oregon, very working class, semi-rural. It's basically farmers and some sort of industrial worker types. And it is that classic kind of Trump country. And I remember sitting there in the waiting room listening to this and thinking, because everyone could hear it in the waiting room, I was thinking, oh my God, when is the lynching going to start? But it's something that needs to be taken into account. Now, I am open borders. I'm an open borders guy entirely. But, you know, it's not like these people who are upset about immigrants coming into the country have no basis whatsoever. It is true. They use publicly funded, taxpayer funded programs and infrastructure and, you know, welfare and education system. I mean, it's coming out of their pockets. I get that. So, you know, it's border. We need to have open borders, but we also need to call into question the welfare state.
Oh, certainly. Although I'll rush to add that as part of the welfare reforms in the late 90s, virtually all means-tested transfer programs were illegals were certainly kicked off of, but even legal immigrants for something like 5 or 10 years. And it's, you know, one of the things that's interesting that people don't talk a lot about is that the single biggest cost of immigrants, legal and otherwise, on the U.S. taxpayer are actually K-12 schooling, because a Supreme Court ruling in the 80s said that regardless of legal status, all children living in the U.S. are entitled to a free public education. So that could be 10 or 20 grand a year per kid, depending on where you're living. And a lot of those kids are actually American citizens anyway, if they were born here. But it's a big cost. And then there are a lot of emergency medical bills, which add up to very little of the overall healthcare spending in the country, but in particular places can be pretty overwhelming. It would be nice, to go back to your critique of libertarians who are very oftentimes very anti-immigrant, I hear a lot of people say, look, you know, even Milton Friedman said you can't have open borders in a welfare state, so let's close the borders. And I'm always amazed that, like, if you're a libertarian and your answer to that conundrum is let's close the borders rather than get rid of the welfare state and replace it with a true social safety net of a minimal one, I'm always kind of amazed. Here's a question for you, though, Thad. Has there been a time where we've also, for at least since the 80s, we've been under – it's dipping down lately, but we've been under a sustained – period of a pretty high, consistent, persistent immigration, both legal and illegal. And again, it's been slowing down over the past, since the financial crisis and whatnot. But it seems in the past, and particularly the great immigration influx from the 1870s, 1880s through about the 1920s, was followed by a, you know, decade-long pause because of the Depression, because of World War II, because of the rebuilding of Europe, to a point where 1970 was something like under 5% of the population of America was foreign-born. From my understanding of the stats, that's the lowest ever in the United States. Is there a time where we've been able to kind of deal with a long influx of immigrants that wasn't punctuated by a kind of long stop on that? And, you know, and what's fascinating to me always is that by 1970, Italians, you know, The Godfather, the novel and the movie came out and kind of recast Italians, not just as a type of American, but the archetypal American. Same thing happened in different ways for Jews after World War II, where you had a series of great writers and works that kind of refigured the Jewish experience as the, or, you know, as one of the central American experiences. Similar things happened with Germans, even with blacks. You know, are we able to assimilate, and I don't want to say assimilate, but are we able to get comfortable with a multicultural America while they're still coming in? Or is it always something that it's just anxiety inducing and then you take a breather and then you start the cycle again?
Well, okay, so here's what I could say about that. I mean, there is no evidence that relatively open borders has led to any sort of economic decline in the United States. If you look at the great immigration wave of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, that coincided, of course, with, you know, the great expansion of American capitalism. And same has been true essentially since 1965 as well. You know, I don't know. I mean, poor people, and I know this is, libertarians know this, but most people don't. You know, poor people in America, despite what you hear, actually live far better than they did in 1965 in the United States. So that's coincided with the second great wave of immigration. Crime has gone down, as we know, over the last 25 years or so. There's no evidence that it's bad in any sort of broad way, historically.
But the food is worse. Isn't American food worse with all these immigrants coming in here?
No, food was so great in the 1960s. and I wish we could get back to that. That would be making America great.
And again, that, you know, that half Velveeta. Second. When you have to hit the ATM, you know, that extra button for which language do you want? I mean, how much is that shaving off of American productivity every time we take money out of the bank?
I get a lot of work done usually during that second, so I resent that. Thank you, Trump.
Catherine, do you want to very quickly say what's coming up in the next issue of Reason, which people can subscribe to at reason.com/subscribe?
Sure. This is the other potential silver lining of Trump. We are trying valiantly to give the guy fair shakes. And so we are looking at his deregulatory agenda and its prospects for realization in the world. I've got an editor's note about his skinny budget. Matt Welsh has talked to every libertarian wonk in the universe to parse the deregulatory stuff that might be coming down the pike. We also have a great interview with PJ O'Rourke by none other than Nick Gillespie. Lots of good stuff in the next issue. Come check it out.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. I want to thank Thaddeus Russell. He's a historian and the author of A Renegade History of the United States. Check him out at ThaddeusRussell.com and check out his Renegade University. Thad, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
And I want to thank Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks.
You betcha.
All right. And this has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I'm Nick Gillespie, and thanks for listening.